Roger Davis is a PhD psychologist, has agreed to speak this evening on psychological problems associated with LASIK. But he has co-authored college textbooks with titles such as Personality Disorders in Modern Life, and he co-authored the Oxford textbook of psychopathology. So we're very fortunate to have someone with this level of expertise that can talk to us about some of the things that LASIK patients experience following complications from their surgery. So, if you're ready to go, Roger.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Jerry. First of all, let me give you the web address where you can pull up my PowerPoint. It's if you're sitting in front of a computer, and the address is www.thevisioncommunity.com/RSSS. The formal title of the presentation is Diagnosis and Assessment of Psychological Trauma in the Refractive Surgery Complications Patient. And this is a little different than the title that I previously had for this presentation, which was just simply Refractive Surgery Shock Syndrome. And the reason that I wanted to go ahead and change the title was because I wanted the presentation to be geared toward psychologists and psychiatrists who may be seeing the refractive surgery patient for the first time. And as many of you are aware, most of the public knows LASIK and knows refractive surgery through its marketing. And for example, one of the advertisements that I used to hear about LASIK when I first relocated to Florida was laser eye surgery, 10 minutes of painless surgery, wake up to perfect vision for the rest of your life. And certainly it did not turn out to be that way for the people who are on the call today, most of the people who are on the call today. And it certainly didn't turn out that way for me. But this is how many psychologists and psychiatrists probably know refractive surgery, is through the marketing. So I wanted to tailor the presentation, retitle it, and tailor it for them. And as Jerry said earlier, I have, I'm just going to give you a little short review of my credentials. I've got a couple of specialty areas when I did my graduate work in psychology. One of those was test construction and psychometrics, co-author of several of the Milan inventories. The Milan Clinical Multiaxial Inventory is the most widely used pencil and paper test to diagnose personality tests in the world. It's considered the standard in that regard. Also co-author on Disorders of Personality, DSM-4 and Beyond, which is considered the classic text in the field. And I wrote the first undergraduate textbook on personality disorders to introduce college students to these constructs called Personality Disorders in Modern Life. In 1998, I did all this stuff mainly before 1998. And when I finally got out of graduate school, I had about 20 publications, and many of them were co-authored tests and co-authored books. In 1998, I had LASIK, and that launched my life in a completely new direction. And if you go to slide 4, you'll see what my vision looked like post-LASIK through my dominant eye. And what you'll see there is some text, and you will see a ghost image hanging immediately below that. And this was incredibly surprising to me because I had 20/15 visual acuity through the right eye, my dominant eye, and yet at the same time, the eye was useless. And one of the reasons it was so surprising to me is that I had really done my homework. I had interviewed 3 surgeons, and I was told that I was the perfect candidate by each of the surgeons. And I picked one of the top guys in North America to do my surgery, and he had done 4,000 surgeries at the time. And today, 4,000 surgeries is nothing. I mean, there are LASIK surgeons walking around who have probably done 50,000 surgeries. But in 1998, 4,000 surgeries was a lot. And my surgeon had also authored a book on LASIK complications that was probably considered one of the standards in the field. And I wanted somebody who knew what to do. Something did go wrong because I didn't end up with a very good result. So After that, I was told by my surgeon that there was nothing wrong with my eyes. I remember sitting in the chair 3 months after my surgery, and I was looking at two images of my surgeon through my right eye, and I remember explaining what my vision was like, and I remember him shaking his head and saying, you know, your visual needs just must be really high. And I remember the panic that kind of swept across me when he said that, because we had had a discussion about my LASIK, and I had told him that I was a scholar and a researcher, and I didn't want to take any chance on creating problems reading, because I thought it would impact my career, and that if anything could possibly go wrong with this, I didn't want to do it. And I also told him that I wanted to avoid dry eyes. And so at 3 months, I was sitting there in the chair looking at two images of him, and my eyes were incredibly dry. And I'll be absolutely honest, I don't know if he understood the magnitude of my complaints or if he understood the magnitude of my complaints, and he was simply monitoring his presentation so carefully that he wanted to seem ignorant. I just don't know. Eventually, I did have another surgery at 3 months on my right eye. That did clear up some of the ghosting. However, a problem that I share with many of the people that I know, you know, I know most of the people on the call today, I developed extreme dry eyes, couldn't sleep through the night, was constantly dumping ointment into my eyes every night, pulling out my lower lid, putting in this ophthalmic grade Vaseline, and kind of trying to get a good night's rest as a result of that, but it never really worked. Shared with a few close friends of mine what I was going through, ended up moving back in with my parents for a year, spent most of 1999. You know, there, moved back in with my parents. There I was, you know, with a PhD, living with my mom and dad, literally kind of went back home to my mama because the dry eye was so severe. Eventually, I was told that I was just one in 10,000 patients. And then I remember one night a friend who knew my circumstances called and said, Raj, ABC's 2020 is doing an expose on LASIK, and you might want to tune in. So I tuned in to 2020, and I found out about a website called the Surgical Eyes Foundation. And I visited the website, and I discovered close to 1,000 people that were registered there at the time. Some of them had had radiokeratotomy, but most of them had had LASIK. And they were all telling more or less the same story. Now let's go on to slide 6. They were telling me that they had no real informed consent for the surgery. They were telling me that their surgeons were telling them nothing was wrong with their eyes, which was what my surgeon had done. They were making other allegations. They were saying that the LASIK industry was lying to the public about the nature of risk. They were saying that the industry needed to buy time in order to improve the technology. They were saying that the approvals research that was submitted to the FDA was bad, and therefore the industry needed to buy time. They were saying that the industry needed to suppress public awareness of the severity of LASIK injuries because the industry needed to create the public perception that LASIK was safe. They were saying that the industry needed to manage the casualties because if the casualties could ever obtain any widespread publicity, it would impact the profits of the industry. And many of the patients there regarded themselves as victims of medical cover-ups, and some more than one. You can talk about the dry eye cover-up. You can talk about the night vision cover-up. These are all things that patients were talking about. And this was very disturbing because up until the time that I found the Surgical Eyes Foundation online, I think I had been coping. I wasn't coping really well, but I had kind of been coping heroically, and I was slower at getting my work done, but I was still being effective. And this news incredibly derailed me because it did not seem possible to me that that surgeons, medical doctors, would be capable of this kind of thing. And so it was stunning news to me. And I think I developed a little bit of PTSD as a result of that. Well, the Surgical Eyes Foundation had a bulletin board on their site at the time, and you could private message patients through the bulletin board. And that's how I started communicating with many patients and developed correspondence and became friends with them and started to make observations about their psychological state. and I eventually became the research director of the Surgical Eyes Foundation, and I'm on slide 7 right now. And during this time, you know, talking to many patients, talking to other people who had talked to many patients, we had an epidemic of depression and suicidal ideation, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder. And new patients, the industry was rolling out LASIK at this time across the United States, and new patients were constantly finding the website and registering every day. And they were more or less, with some minor variations, they were all telling the same story that I just told you. In other words, this is the story that many of the people on the call have experienced themselves. If there's any doubt, you know, I could call out names and I could ask for you guys to back me up, and I know you would. All of these patients were in various states of psychological distress, and it was not only because of their vision. I mean, most of it was due to LASIK, obviously, but it was also because of their experiences with their surgeon and with the industry. Let's move on here. Let's see. This was something, as I said earlier, this was something that it derailed me, and I didn't know how to deal with it, and I wanted to run away from it. And, you know, sometimes I would take breaks from the website for a couple of days or even a week at a time. At the same time, I was the research director of the website, and when I joined the website, there was already a study in progress, and it was called the Complications of Refractive Surgery Study. And the idea was the patients would simply type into a blank the complications that they were having. And let's go on to slide 8 now, and I just want to read the results of this to you. We gathered 517 responses, and after exclusion criteria, there were 392 responses that were finally coded. The big findings of the study were that 58 subjects reported suicidal ideation as a result of their surgical procedure, and 83% of this group were referred to as successes by their surgeon. There was another group of 115 subjects who reported severe depression as a result of their surgical procedure, and 76% of this group were referred to as successes by their surgeon. So this is going all the way back to probably 2001, 2002. And at that time, based upon the communications with patients, informal communications with patients, lots of patients, and as a result of this study, we knew that LASIK could be so damaging to people that people would end up with various depressive syndromes and people would end up wanting to take their own life. It was obvious to us. It was obvious to us not only because of the data that we were gathered, it was obvious to us because of our own experiences. And nobody really knew what to do about it. And I'm not really sure that anybody really knows what to do about it today. Let's go on to slide 10. And we did do some calculations of suicidal ideation as a function of the specific complications that people experienced. And what's interesting about this data is that dry eye emerged as probably the most terrible complication of LASIK. And, of course, that was ironic to me because that was one of the complications that I had expressed to my surgeon that I definitely didn't want. But like so many of the people here, I was told that if you have dry eye syndrome, all you have to do is use eye drops a couple of times a day or in the morning, and you know, it's no big deal. So it was not put forward to me as if it were a complication. It was put forward to me as if it were simply a side effect and that it was easy to deal with, and you just put the eye drops in a couple of times and that's it. But it certainly didn't work out that way for me. Slide 11, you'll notice another study, this study basically concluded this is a utility study, and the idea here is how can we compare dry eye to other health conditions, and they use utilities to put these things on the same scale. And the findings were that the utilities for more severe forms of dry eye are in the range of conditions like class 3 or class 4 angina, okay, which are widely recognized as lowering health utilities. And I thought that was pretty significant. And let's move on to slide 13. And you've just heard me talk about my experiences and what I heard other patients saying. And For people who will find the presentation, those here who are on the call will recognize the people who are listed on slide 13. You will know them, you'll know their faces, and you may actually have been at the April 25th meeting. But people who may find this presentation for the first time may not be familiar with it. So let me give a little bit of background. This issue about LASIK and depression and LASIK and suicidal ideation has been boiling probably since LASIK was first launched and probably since patients first began to compare their stories and their experiences. But it took until 2008 for this controversy, these issues, to finally reach any kind of public awareness. And the FDA finally held a meeting of patients on April 25th in Gettysburg, Maryland, and a number of people who had had complications, a number of their family members actually spoke at that meeting. And if you click on the little pictures of people here, you'll actually go to their websites, or you'll actually go to their videos, which are held at YouTube, and you can hear what they're saying. On slide 13, I want to go ahead and click on Dr. Mike Mullery's presentation. His is the leftmost presentation in the top row, and let's go ahead and listen to that one.
My name is Michael Mullery, MD, MBA. I'm a graduate of the University of Notre Dame and the Pennsylvania State University College of Medicine. I'm a board-certified medical specialist with a secondary interest in psychiatry. The refractive surgery industry has known since its inception that LASIK surgery carries a risk of depression and suicide. Bad outcomes are not rare, and these outcomes can result in serious qualitative and quantitative vision losses, including blindness. Now the FDA is allowing the very entities that have publicly engaged in minimizing these risks to conduct studies looking at LASIK and its effect on quality of life. This is an overt conflict of interest that defies both common sense and the scientific method. There can be no objectivity when the bottom line is the very survival of one's multi-billion dollar cash cow. It is time to leave the study of the psychological consequences of vision loss after LASIK to mental health professionals that are better trained to study this and lack any financial interest in the outcome. In 1999, the journal Psychosomatics, July-August, researchers from Griffith University in Australia, in conjunction with the World Health Organization's Center for Suicide Research, reported on a study that compared suicide secondary to vision loss to suicide secondary to hearing loss. The study found that 63% of hearing-impaired suicides had a history of mental illness, compared to only 8% of the sight-impaired suicides. In this study, fear of sight loss and the uncertainty about future vision emerged as greater risk factors for suicide than complete blindness. Most importantly, however, sight loss itself was identified as the main causal factor for vision suicides, whereas hearing suicides were coupled with several other causal factors. I would estimate that I have interviewed close to 75 people who have developed suicidal ideation as a result of LASIK. And what I found is that very few of these patients have a history of depression or other psychiatric problems. This finding is consistent with the Griffith University WHO study of vision loss and suicide, and inconsistent with the industry's claims that pre-existing psychopathology is responsible. If vision loss is causal, as the Griffith University WHO study claims, then better screening for pre-existing psychological problems is not the answer. Stopping the vision loss is. How many totally preventable deaths can the FDA allow when there is absolutely no medical need for a procedure? In the following case, LASIK itself is undoubtedly the sole causal factor in this man's suicidal ideation. AJ underwent LASIK and ended up with a result that his surgeon could not explain. Severely overcorrected with irregular astigmatism, AJ could not even read the big E after his surgery. In AJ's own words, my life and world changed beyond description the next days following my surgery. First, fear set in as I felt alone and helpless as my life became an endless routine of sitting in front of slit lamps with no improvement in my vision. I was constantly nauseous from the vision imbalance and resulting headaches. Then, out of the blue, panic set in. I began to cry all the time. There seemed no easy way out of the situation I had created for myself. The simple solution to eliminate glasses had become my first ever experience with depression. Deep, deep depression, which I tried to hide from my wife. But my business was suffering, and I became obsessed with my vision to the point that I was becoming unglued. I had always been a very stable person. I had no history of mental illness, depression, or drug addiction, nor had I ever been prone to violence. But now, for the first time in my life, I was suicidal and full of rage. How could I stop this from happening to someone else? And how could I make my own pain go away? Another case, a dental student without any history of psychological problems reports himself becoming suicidal after his LASIK left him with constant headaches, blur, and vision that could not be corrected with glasses. I shudder to think how close I was to ending my life, he says. Taking 8 courses and studying for a national license exam with one semi-functional eye was a hellish nightmare. This patient reached the point where he found himself with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in one hand and a loaded gun in the other. Incidentally, his surgeon considered him a success. Another patient, SD, with no prior psychological history, reports becoming suicidal when LASIK surgery to correct her myopia produced finger-only vision in one eye and 20/200 vision in the other. She is now awaiting bilateral corneal transplantations. She reports that collusion by local refractive surgeons added to her sense of despair, as none of the local refractive surgeons who saw her for second opinions even mentioned to her that she had ectasia. In conclusion, patients are killing themselves as a result of failed LASIK. A risk of death is not an acceptable risk for a totally unnecessary procedure with no medical benefit. Research on this issue remains virtually nil, and thus the full extent of this catastrophic complication remains unknown. Public safety is best served by a moratorium on these procedures so that these previously unstudied risks can be evaluated and understood. Studies looking at the effects of unsuccessful LASIK on depression and suicidal ideation should be done by mental health professionals and suicidologists who are better able to assess mental health issues and who lack the financial conflict of interest that LASIK surgeons and co-managing optometrists obviously have. If a moratorium is not immediately instituted, the labeling of the excimer lasers for the surgical correction of myopia, hyperopia, and astigmatism should be altered to include risk of suicide and depression, even in the absence of any pre-existing psychiatric history. Thank you.
Okay, I hope that came across clearly for most of the people on the call there. There's a number of other videos that are represented there. I don't want to take time to go through all of them because each one is about 5 minutes long and it would take about a half an hour. But for psychologists, psychiatrists, and other mental health professionals who will find this presentation, I think that review of these videos is absolutely essential because you will get a very different picture of LASIK as a result of watching these videos. And one of the things you will notice is how much convergence there is between the stories that the patients are telling. And sadly and distastefully, many of these stories feature corruption and ideas of conspiracy. But that's just how it is. It may be distasteful, but it is what it is. One of the take-home lessons from this is that if you are a mental health professional who is seeing a patient who has complications, to have complications from LASIK is not simply to be a patient with complications. It is to be a patient who is suddenly baptized into a whole set of experiences that you had no idea were waiting for you. You will find an online community of people who are telling the same stories that you hear in these videos. Some of these people will believe that they are simply random events. Something went wrong with my surgery, and who knows what it was. Some of these people will say that I believe my surgeon made a mistake, but is fundamentally honest. Some of these people are going to say that my surgeon is minimizing my complaints and not recording them in the medical chart. And they will, of course, begin to question the credentials, the veracity, the integrity of their surgeon as a result. Other patients are saying that the LASIK industry itself is fundamentally evil. Other patients are saying that the LASIK industry and the FDA are in cahoots, and there is a corruptive form of collusion between the industry and the FDA. So this is a variety of things that patients can experience, and none of these things are particularly enjoyable, as you might imagine, and all of these things have impacts on the mental health of patients. And if we go to slide 17, I think it's important to make the point that for patients who do believe that they are victims of a medical conspiracy, they're getting this data, they're getting converging evidence from a variety of different levels. They're getting evidence from their own surgeon, who's telling them maybe telling them nothing is wrong with their eyes when obviously they're looking through their eyes, seeing is believing, right? They're getting information from opinion leaders in the casualty community, probably the most brilliant and smartest people in the community who have reviewed the FDA clinical trials research are unanimous in believing that the research is fundamentally flawed and that many things in the research that were put forward as side effects in order to get LASIK approved are in fact complications, and the complications have been hidden in the category of side effects. Patients who come into our community are find themselves in touch with other patients who are telling the same story. They may find bogus science, which is published by the industry. There are patients who maintain that, that bogus science is published in order to protect against the possibility of class action lawsuits. Patients may find themselves, they may want second opinions about their eyes. They may travel to other refractive surgeons in their same city, or they may travel all across the United States. The second opinion doctors, many times we hear, also minimize the complaints and the suffering that the patient is experiencing. And if we go to slide 18, I want to refer, if you are a psychologist or psychiatrist and listening to this call, I want to refer you to a website called LASIKcomplications.com, because this is an essential resource for understanding what many patients feel that they are experiencing. There is a, we can put the matter of whether issues such as medical conspiracy are true, we can put that completely aside. One of the most important tenets of psychotherapy is that you have to start with where the patient is. You have to understand what their mental dynamics are and their mental structures. And if you can understand that, if you can understand the emotions that they're experiencing as a result of these dynamics, then you can begin to affect change. The way to understand this is to familiarize yourself with the evidentiary basis that patients are citing to support their perspective. And LASIKcomplications.com is an essential resource for this. Okay, let's skip forward now and let's go on to slide 20. And here I want to introduce something called vision simulations. Vision simulations are literally what it says. They're simply simulations of people's vision. And I first began to prepare vision. I began to prepare vision simulations while I was the research director of Surgical Eyes. And as I said previously, we had an epidemic of people who were depressed in various states of suicidal ideation and PTSD. And there were a few simulations on the website when I first joined the site late in 1999 and early in 2000, but they weren't especially good, and they didn't capture the full range of visual phenomena that patients with LASIK complications can experience. So eventually I got out my graphics program, and I began creating these things for myself. And this culminated in a website called thevisioncommunity.com. And let's go ahead and skip forward to slide 22. And the idea here is that by using vision simulations, patients can immediately begin to build empathy, because now anybody can see what the patient, him or herself, is seeing through their own eyes. All right, and we go to slide 23, and that's the example of ghosting that you've seen before. This was my vision through my right eye immediately after LASIK, and by seeing the simulation, the quality of life impact becomes obvious. Okay, you can see that this would not be an especially fun place to be, and I've had patients ask me multiple times, well, why were vision simulations not used in the approvals research? You know, why did it take a psychologist in order to come up with these vision simulations and put up a website that would allow patients to communicate their vision? And I don't have the answer to that with 100% certainty, but I think that if you were to show people who are candidates for LASIK pictures of ghosting, pictures of starbursting, pictures of halos, glare, and so on, I think it would communicate the nature of risk much more clearly. And I doubt that many of those patients would have LASIK. Let's move on to slide 24. Slide 24 shows a picture of halos. You guys already know what these look like. Slide 25, starbursting. Slide 26 is starbursting from a suicidal patient who had large pupils. Unfortunately, in the approvals research that was submitted to the FDA, I understand that they were mandated to gather data on the relationship between pupil size and outcomes, and that this data was never gathered. As a result, patients with large pupils see a variety of nighttime phenomena, which can be incredibly severe. This is an actual example that was prepared for a patient for use in court. Slide 27 is another actual example prepared for a patient for use in court. So is slide 28. And then the next set of slides, beginning with slide 29, this material is somewhat technical because it gets at the, we've called this refractive surgery shock syndrome, but there is no real formal research on this. And the symptoms that people manifest are kind of all over the place. Some people develop anxiety states. Some people develop depression. Some people develop substance use disorders or dissociative states. And we don't know whether all of the people who develop refractive surgery shock syndrome experience pretty much all of these symptoms, or whether they experience 80% of these symptoms, or whether there are people who experience exclusively depression as a result of their LASIK without any associated anxiety. So there's a question as to how tightly these symptoms cluster, and that's what I wanted to get at in slide 30. Let me just look forward here. Let's go on to slide 34. And this is something that I spoke briefly about at the FDA hearing on April 25th. There are five stages of coping with refractive surgery complications. And this kind of gets at how refractive surgery shock syndrome develops. On slide 35, you've got what I call the marketing stage. These are expectations that are produced by advertising and testimonials. And these expectations set patients up for the development, particularly of post-traumatic stress, because marketing has nothing to do with informed consent, right? You don't see stuff about ghosting or halos or starbursting. You don't see this mentioned in marketing or in advertisements. So people expect that their LASIK outcome is going to be perfect, and they expect that LASIK is absolutely safe. They expect that it is what the industry says it is. And then they have LASIK, and now they're in stage two. They're in a post-surgical crisis stage. Now they've got all kinds of visual aberrations, and their careers are adversely impacted. They may not know if they're going to be able to keep their jobs. If they're not going to be able to keep their jobs, then where is their income going to come from? How are they going to make their house payment? How are they going to make their car payment? So there are all these kind of cascading effects as a result of a bad LASIK outcome. But at this stage, the patient still has faith in their surgeon, and they're still appealing to their doctor, and they want to believe that everything will be okay. And this was kind of where I was after I had LASIK up until 3 months when I had my retreatment. You know, I just kind of put out of my mind the possibility that this would never get better, and it was much easier for me to do that and simply to try to continue to have faith in my surgeon. My surgeon knows what he's doing. My surgeon has written a major text on this. I can trust my surgeon, okay? But then when the problems don't resolve, patients kind of enter stage three, which I've called the doubting stage. And at this point, that they begin to lose faith in the surgeon, who may have told them, well, all complications resolve at 6 months. Dry eye resolves at 6 months. Your dry eye will go away. 6 months comes and goes, and the patient's vision hasn't changed, or the dry eye hasn't changed, or maybe the vision is even worse. Okay, some patients will develop ectasia after LASIK. Then the patient begins searching for other solutions, and they begin searching for second. They may search for second opinion doctors, for example, and they may have their experience with their second opinion doctor. They may also find their suffering is minimized, which then further exacerbates their psychological trauma, and they will begin looking for information about LASIK on the internet, and they will find websites. Such as LASIKcomplications.com, and they will find websites like LASIKflap.com. And it's at this point that they will find a lot of information which they have never been told before by their surgeon, by the marketing, by anyone in the industry with whom they've come in contact with. And it's at this point then that the patient realizes that there are many other people out there, many other patients out there that have had complications, and they are, in fact, a part of a much larger community, and they have to decide what they want to do with that. And some patients will decide never to join the community. They will decide that this knowledge of things that other patients are saying, allegations of medical corruption, is simply too much for them to deal with. So they never actually become part of the community. They kind of always remain at the fringes. Other people, you know, people want to know, how did I get here? You know, what is my history? People are always doing genealogical research. Some people have to know the truth. They have to know the truth, no matter where it leads. They want to know the meaning of their lives, and they will hunt down information zealously, no matter what it is. And obviously, it exacerbates psychological trauma to do this, but for these individuals, it's much more important to know than not to know. Let's see here. I'm just skipping forward through the presentation. Are there any questions?
Well, I had an observation about the psychology of the LASIK surgeons, starting from when they're medical students. Should I hold it or share it now?
Why don't you hold that question until the end, because that's going to take us far afield of our topic. Are there any questions about things we discussed previously? Okay. Well, let's skip forward then all the way to slide 57. And in slide 57, we talk about specifically about suicidal fantasies and why patients, I don't think that anybody really wants to commit suicide. The idea among mental health professionals is that suicide expresses a desire to escape, but people want to escape for different reasons. And what I've done in slides 57 to 63 is I've kind of tried to isolate some of these reasons. Some people want to commit suicide because they want to end the journey. They've traveled all over the country. They're looking for solutions to their problems. They've seen, you know, 5, 10, 20 ophthalmologists. They've been looking for contact lenses. For whatever reason, it hasn't worked out. They've spent thousands of dollars on solutions. You know, they feel like they're a hamster in a habit trail, and they're in the little wheel, and their life is just going nowhere, and they want to get off the wheel, get off the journey. Next slide, some people want to escape from the anxiety and unpredictability of complications. You can imagine getting up in the morning, and because of dry eye, your vision may be different every day. You don't know if you're going to be able to keep your job or not. You don't know if you're going to be able to make payments or not. You don't know how different your life is going to be. Is your spouse going to divorce you because your lives together are now much different than they were before? All right. Some people feel that others just don't understand the severity of their complications, and this is something that you run into when you talk to husbands about wives and wives about husbands, is that even family members don't really seem to understand. And sometimes suicide can express a desire just to have your complications understood, or the severity of them understood. Next slide, there are some people who, looking at the situation that they find themselves in with their surgeon and with the industry, with their second opinion doctors, with the FDA, they just want to get away from the whole thing. And they just want to go back to God, to go back to something that is pure. Okay. Go to the next slide. Some people just want to withdraw into a protective shell. They don't want to be hurt anymore. You will see patients sometimes who have, probably as a result of severe depression, they have extreme psychomotor retardation or extreme numbing and avoidance. They're very slow to respond to you. They don't seem to have any spontaneity. There's no richness in the narrative as they talk about their lives or even about their current circumstances. They may seem dissociated. Other people, some people cope in different ways. Some people put on a face every day, even though they have severe LASIK complications, and they may feel that they just can't communicate or convey to others how bad it really is. Maybe no one's going to understand it anyway, so why should I try to communicate it with people? And these people try to pretend that they're all right. And you can say that, okay, maybe it's a form of cognitive dissonance, but at some level, these people have recognition that they are severely impacted, and they just can't keep up this front any longer. And finally, there are people who have intense self-blame as a result of their lazy. And these people, they feel duped by deceptive and corrupt industry, but they may blame themselves for not checking out their doctor. All right, they may say, I should have been more careful. I should have known to look into it much deeper than I did. They may conclude that they were never a candidate, and if they'd only found a particular website, that their lives would be completely different right now. So there are all kinds of reasons that people want to commit suicide as a result of LASIK. The next slide is about perfectionism. You know, despite communicating with 250 to 350 people, I have never observed a patient that I felt was being overly perfectionistic about their vision. Perfectionism seems to be a rationale that's developed by the industry in order to excuse itself and blame the patient. Another one is body dysmorphic disorder. This is the idea. People with body dysmorphic disorder tend to be overly concerned about a minor imperfection in their body. You may see some surgeons talk about this. The problem with that is that your vision isn't public. That's why we have vision simulations. And body dysmorphic disorder is concerned with body irregularities that are socially observable. Vision is not socially observable, and therefore this diagnosis is simply inappropriate. And there's a bunch of other slides left, but we're about 50 minutes into the presentation right now, so I'm going to go ahead and open it up for questions. And if other people or mental health professionals find the presentation online, then certainly that material will be there for them to look through.
This is Barbara, and I can't look at a computer. I have epithelial cell ingrowth and the severe dry eyes, and I ended up with glaucoma. But I can't take antidepressants because of the glaucoma. There's no safe antidepressants that they can administer. And I was just wondering if anyone knew of any antidepressant, anything that my glaucoma doctor, he's willing to look at anything, but he said there are no prescriptions that I can take.
What are you doing about
this
vision?
Specific as, does anybody know any alternative medicine? He said that will decrease the pressures also. He told me about ginkgo biloba, that it is it's a herb that they've looked at that does decrease the pressure temporarily up to an hour. Their study showed up to an hour because this is not a prescription type medication. There has not been a lot of studies done with it. That's one thing that will decrease the pressure. They still haven't stabilized my pressure. They've got them on the lower side, but I've still experienced the exacerbation of pressure shooting up to 30 in my left eye. That was about 2 months ago. And this just leads constantly to fear and anxiety. What's going on? I've got a doctor that treats the front of my eyes and an ocular surface, and I've got a doctor that treats the back of my eyes, the ocular
surface. Have you asked about Inderol, a beta blocker? I don't think that causes an increase in pressure. I think it causes a decrease, and that can be a good anti-anxiety medication for some people. Also, benzodiazepines, which they're really reluctant to give to people, that can be helpful. They are a completely different class of drugs than the antidepressants, and they might work for you.
Inderol, so, and what was the second one?
Lorazepam.
Lorazepam, okay.
Also known as Ativan.
That's a sleeping medication. Ativan. Oh, okay. I'm on Ativan, like anti... No, I'm not
anti-anxiety.
I'm on Xanax.
Okay, that's
similar.
Yeah,
that's
Zerol
similar.
And Ativan. Okay.
Zerol
might help you.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask...
I'm sorry, the phone broke up.
There was Scott Tolson here. I just wanted to ask you, are you seeing a psychiatrist?
I'm seeing a psychologist. I'm sure I'm his first LASIK complication patient. But I'm going to give him these websites.
Okay, because, you know, psychologists can't necessarily, you know, they can't prescribe. Psychiatrists have the whole physician's desk reference available to them, and they can tell you, you know, they'll be able to from your symptomology, pick out what drugs they feel would be most effective for you, and then also be able to tell whether they'll be okay to be used with a glaucoma patient. I think that, you know, in dealing with, you know, significant anxiety and depression, meaning significant to the point where, you know, it's not caused so much by outside, you know, circumstances that come and go. Now you have this thing that you have to live with on a day-to-day basis. Even if you don't have a biochemical tendency towards depression or anxiety, you've now got something that kind of lives with you or that you have to live with. And because of that, because it's something that doesn't come and go, because it's now kind of, you know, part of your life, I just would advocate seeing a psychiatrist, because you're going to be able, you're going to need, you may need help. You may need help medication-wise, and a psychologist just can't do that, and they generally don't have that knowledge. In addition, there's, you know, other answers out there. I think Dr. Boschnick's on the line, and I know he's going to want to have something to say.
One of the issues, I think, in general, one of the issues, if you do see a psychiatrist for medications, you may be prescribed an SSRI, Paxil, Prozac, Lexapro, Celexa, whatever. One of the things that you should be aware of is that these drugs can cause your pupil to dilate, and if you already tend to have large pupils are associated with degradations of visual quality, and if the size does increase, you may have lower visual quality, which may exacerbate feelings of traumatic stress or suicidal ideation. Also, if you have dry eye, SSRIs can cause a dry eye to get worse.
Almost all of the psychotropic medications. This is Ed Boschnick. Almost all the psychotropic medications affect the tear film.
I have severe dry eye. And that's another thing they're concerned about. They will not give me any, when the epithelial cells have went active, they will not give me pain medication because of the dryness, the side effect of dry eyes.
Can I add something about it's not exactly an alternative therapy, but I would say it's a good practice. This is Roger Bratt. And what I'm talking about is when you are first dealing with a bad outcome from refractive surgery, like Roger detailed, it's incomprehensible. You're in this situation where you're trying to comprehend something that is incomprehensible. And I think it's very important when you're in a situation like that to be, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but since we're on a timeline, I'll use the word aggressive, with your diet, your nutrition, your exercise, and your health practices. In other words, to eat 8 to 12 fruits and vegetables a day, whether you like it or not, because it's good for your body. To take a hot bath every day, whether you like it or not, if it feels good and helps you relax. To exercise appropriately, because it helps you work through the feelings that you need to work through. And so, I mean, things like that are good for dealing with symptoms of depression, sadness, anger, and fear.
And I also think it's never give up.
I walk to keep the fluid flowing, basically. they want that. They said it would help the fluid flow in the eyes. And I weigh about 160 pounds. I eat healthy. I sleep. I'm on generic Ambien. I never took anything prior to this. I was a flight attendant. I never took any drugs, so I'm sleeping pills, whatever. So this has all been a new walk.
When did you have your LASIK?
December the 28th of 2006.
Wow.
And what are your visual symptoms?
I'm legally blind in my left eye and 20/50 to 20/80 in my right eye. I no longer drive. And that's on my good days.
Wow.
Has anybody tried to improve your vision with contact lenses?
They're scared. No, contact lenses, I don't know. They're waiting to get three doctors' opinions in. What kind of contact lenses? I've been told about these contact lenses in Boston. They're $8,000. You've got to go up there and live for months.
Those are called scleral lenses. That's the Boston Foundation for Sight. Scleral lenses. Scleral lenses work very nicely with a lot of post-LASIK patients. But there are other technologies that are out there too. Other lens designs, not just the scleral lenses. There are other things too.
There's other contact lenses.
There's other types of specialty lens designs that are intention is to resolve a lot of the problems with dryness, aberrations, double vision, and so forth.
Well, what doctor prescribes these? Well, I'm waiting to go to another doctor in Cincinnati, so maybe he's an ocular surface doctor, he's a cornea specialist, maybe he can put some light on this.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Ed is an optometrist, and Ed prescribes scleral lenses. Scleral lenses, which are similar to the Boston lenses, but they're definitely not as expensive. And Ed has worked with many patients in our community to help them recover their vision. And you should probably email Ed privately and talk about the solutions that might be available to you.
Yeah, my telephone card is expiring, so I have to say goodbye, unfortunately.
Okay.
And it was really good meeting all of you people. And my email is RogerEBratt@yahoo.com, and I have like 30 seconds left on my phone card.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for joining in, Roger.
Thank you, Roger.
Bye-bye, Roger.
Bye.
I have information on my website. I don't know if it's okay to mention my website, Roger.
Yeah, it's fine with me. I think you should mention the website.
There's information on LASIK and different technologies out there. If you want to go to my website and just explore, it's the address is eyefreedom.com, eyefreedom.com. If you just want to move around, there are patient videos and there's explanations about some of the symptoms that we discussed tonight.
Okay. And that's where I can learn more about the lens design?
Yeah, different lenses. Here, eyefreedom, eyefreedom.com.
Eyefreedom.com.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Is there anything else? Anyone else have questions or comments?
We're talking about a conspiracy. I just want to tell you, over the years, I've never heard of a second opinion going against the operating surgeon. This doesn't happen. The whole thing is to protect one another, watch each other's back. So if you want to call that a conspiracy, I guess that's it. But I can't tell you how many patients I've seen over the years who've gone for second and third opinions. I have a patient who is going next week to Bascom Palmer to see one of the head people at Bascom Palmer for a third opinion. I called Bascom Palmer up and I spoke with the doctor's secretary saying I have all this information, corneal topographies, all detailed information going back for a year. And I was told in no uncertain terms that the doctor was not interested in seeing the information. He'll make his decision on the day the patient comes in. And that told me right away that, you know, geez, I can't believe that. I mean, I would relish someone else's information before.
Terry, if I may, Dr. Terrence O'Brien, he used to be at John Hopkins, and James Schultz, they became my experts. This is Don Morgan. And they actually went against Nevius in my med mail, not only because they became my experts, but because they knew the guy did wrong.
Well,
it's unusual.
Well, he's a black box laser. So, you know, Terry O'Brien is, you know, a paid consultant for one of the big laser companies. So they can go against a guy who uses a black box laser, but they're not going to go against a guy who uses a standard laser.
Okay.
You know, this is Scott Holson again. I mean, I have my surgery in 1997 and 1998, retreat on my right eye, end of 1997, 1998. And when I started to have the symptoms that I had, Raji did a fantastic job. I recognize every aspect of everything that you presented from a personal standpoint. You can't do a better job telling my story than me telling it myself. But I've been through the various phases that you were talking about. I'm not in the computer right now, so I don't have specific phases to refer to. But in going, through all of these, my first inclination when I saw surgicaleyes.org and reading people's stories was, these people are lunatics. These people are out of their mind. They are hysterical, so on and so forth. And now, so many years later, after finding, after my symptoms getting worse and worse, after finding, doctor after doctor that does not want to support, does not want to go against what my, doctor says, and then finding people that would actually go ahead and agree with me in private and then disagree with me in public, or actually, sign up to be expert witnesses for me, take $9,000 from me in retainers, and then, quit 2 weeks before a trial. There is definitely forms of I still don't like to use the word conspiracy because I don't like to sound like I'm a nut, but there's absolutely some amounts of collusion. There is intimidation in terms of, if you go against us, you can't practice at our laser centers. If a doctor can't practice at the laser center, how's he going to make his living?
I think it's an understanding. It's not an overt conspiracy, but it's an unwritten understanding among these guys.
Right, and that's what I would say, and I also have even come to the point where I believe that there are certain instances where there may actually be certain overt conspiracies that take place here and there. I'm not saying it's an industry-wide thing, but I hate to hear myself say this because I feel like I'm cook, but I'm not. I've been through this, and I've been studying this for years, and I've been through the trials, and I've seen the injustices of the way the system works, and it's just very, very
corrupt.
Unfortunate. And, I'm kind of like, Roger, kind of like what you said on the fringes. I mean, I've spoken to you a lot about my, my personal story. Roger also prepared stimulations for my trial. I'm seeing Dr. Boschnick, who's doing amazing work. I live in New York. I'm actually traveling out to Florida to see him tomorrow again. And I kind of lost my train of thought, I guess, in what I originally wanted to say. But Roger, you're totally on point. There are, solutions, or there's help. I shouldn't say solutions, but there's help out there. But you know, if anybody's feeling, you know, this kind of sense of desperation and so forth, I think it takes a lot of different things to get through it. It's been, in terms of moving forward, you know, you're going to, you know, at one point, my psychiatrist said to me, well, you need to find a solution for your eyes. You need to move forward. And I said, I'm not seeing anybody. I was not ready until we got past a certain point. Not that I didn't want a solution, but it was just like, who was I going to trust? Money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars have been thrown out the window. But, you know, you have to take a holistic approach. You have to treat yourself possibly on a psychological level with medication, definitely on a psychological level with some sort of therapy, talk therapy, there's an association called Recovery.inc, which is kind of group therapy that works very well for dealing with feelings of anxiety and depression and changing thought processes, cognitive behavioral therapy. And then, of course, the whole nutritional thing, the whole exercise thing, the whole being involved with life thing, and obviously, you know, seeing what there is out there, because I thought there was nothing out there right now, and I'm seeing signs of promise with my work with Dr. Boschnik.
That's great.
Who is this doctor? Dr.
Ed Boschnik. He's the gentleman that was on the line who had given you the website address. You know, he's trying apparently to not, you know, be self-promoting on this phone call.
Right.
You'll look at it, take a look at that website, ifreedom.com, and you'll see testimonials from various patients and the type of work that he's doing, and also, I guess that's enough said, but...
Hey, Roger?
Yeah.
Hey, this is Matt. Did a great job on the presentation here. And
thank you.
I was hoping to get your insight on what your thought is on this quality of life study that's being started. I suppose it's being started by the FDA and the LASIK physicians or askers.
Well, that's a very interesting question. how can I answer that question? Well, first of all, I think that the most important thing to understand is that the existence of a community of LASIK casualties is political by definition, all right? Whether you like it or not, if you have complications from laser eye surgery and you enter the LASIK complications movement, you're now a political entity. And your depression, your suicidal ideation, your PTSD is going to be complicated by the fact that you have an awareness of yourself as a political entity, because the industry would definitely rather that you did not exist. What's interesting about the quality of life study is it's obviously not going to have random samples of patients. They're not going to be randomly sampling patients who already believe that the industry is deceptive or fails to communicate important information and informed consent, or minimizes the patient's suffering, and whether it's the surgeon or the second opinion doctor. They're not going to be random samples of patients that are going to be included in the research. These are going to be patients who are going to enter the study, and they're going to be naive to the experience of real patients in the real world. In other words, all of us who are here, which the presentation intends to speak to. And the industry will control the information that flows to these patients. And if the industry can control the information that these patients receive, then to a certain extent the industry can control the outcome. Also, I think the industry is very aware that these patients need to be treated with kid gloves. And if there are patients with complications patients come out of their complications with complications as a result of this study, these patients should not be subjected to searching behaviors that tend to exacerbate post-traumatic stress, depression, suicidal ideation, like telling the patient nothing is wrong with their eyes. Okay. So the patients who are going to be in the Asker's FDA study and the patients who are in the real world are going to be very, very, very different. And it's likely that the... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. It will be no different than the clinical trials that have already been out there to get LASIK out there.
Well, you said it. I didn't.
Yeah, one interesting phenomenon that I found from my LASIK experience was, despite the fact that I was suffering from a horrible dry eye and pain post-LASIK, I mean, I was very much believing in my LASIK surgeon and wanting to believe. So, I mean, my thought is, unless it goes out years, I mean, if someone had asked me 4 months after LASIK, which would have been horrific for me, I would have tried to have spun it as positively as possible because I wanted to give my surgeon and myself, for that matter, the benefit of the doubt that there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel like I was led to believe that there would be. So I think it's difficult to really rate patients, especially when it's not being done randomly and, like you said, under a potential kid glove scenario, and get truly honest answers from the patients.
Well, that's a really good point, and the smaller the time interval after surgery that the patients are assessed, probably the outcomes favor the industry more and more. And I think you also made another good point when you talked about still believing in your surgeon. The fact of the matter is that none of us, even though if you go out and talk to patients, you're going to get a never-ending stream of feedback from people who feel like that they have been deceived by corrupt surgeons. And the point that needs to be made, particularly to mental health professionals who may find this presentation, is nobody wants to be a victim of a corrupt industry or a corrupt doctor. We all wish that the medical professionals who were involved in our care had exercised absolute integrity. And we're all very disappointed and traumatized that they didn't. But we certainly wish that they had. It's not a matter of going out and finding evidence of deception or corruption and then trumpeting it with a sense of glee. It would greatly diminish the complexity of all of our lives had people been honest at every step in the process. But that does not seem to be reality.
Yeah. Good point.
No, I mean, this is Scott again. Even at my trial, where I was actually suing my doctor, I spoke about him and to him with respect and dignity. I had never trashed him publicly. People have come to me, and even to this day, maybe not to this day, but to, you know, fairly recently, you know, and this is going back 1997, 1998. Well, do you think I should have LASIK? Well, my answer now is generally no, but even as about a year ago, it was like, well, you know, I don't know that LASIK is bad. Now I'm beginning to really believe that LASIK itself is bad. But back then I would say I don't know that LASIK is bad. I don't even know that my doctor was bad. I know that he made a very bad decision, and that could have been based on, you know, the timing of, you know, when I came into this and so on and so forth. So even so many years later, when I've lost my livelihood and have been emotionally, you know, destroyed in so many ways from this thing, I'm still trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm still,
right,
you know, not wanting to use words like conspiracy, because it's just hard to imagine that a doctor could really be, you know, evil. I mean, but the one thing that was kind of unbelievable was at the end of my trial, after the jury had left and the verdict was found for the doctor, the doctor got up and said to the judge, thank you, Your Honor, for restoring my faith in the justice system. Now, he just won a case, and, you know, there was no reason for him to say that. And, you know, it may not sound that mean, but when, you know, you spent $60,000 and years of your life, and you know, on trying to build, you know, to build this case, and having expert witnesses snatched out from under me. I mean, in certain instances, the actual fighting, the fight, is even worse than the loss of the vision.
Yes.
I relate to so much of this. I've talked to my wife about gouging my eyes out and being blind as opposed to being visually impaired like this, and that maybe that would be easier. I don't know. It's not something I'm going to do. I see a mental health professional. But it's just incredible. You know, I still will wake up. The other night I woke up at 4 in the morning, and sometimes the whole injustice of the whole thing from start to finish, from the beginning, the thoughts that you mentioned before, Roger, about guilt, in terms of doing it to myself in the first place, the whole gamut that you ran, I've been through the whole gamut, and somehow there must be, you know, I don't have the slides in front of me. I don't know where the last slide is, the last good slide, where you somehow, you know, put your life back together and kind of begin to lose all the rage and so forth. So because rage kills you, it takes away parts of your personality, it takes away your energy.
Yes.
And you know, once you get past that, that's like the magical place where I want to get to, and I still haven't gotten there. And this is, you know, now 12 years.
Roger.
Yes,
Ashik, I have to say goodbye, but I want to wish everybody the very best. Okay.
You too.
And
thank you, Ed.
You did a great job. You did a really great job and a great service. Okay, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
I guess I'm going to hang too. I've certainly spoken enough. I wish everybody out there all the best. And great job, Roger. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for talking and telling your story. That took a lot of courage.
Yeah, it's taken me a while to get to the point where I could actually tell the story, because it's not, there are so many distasteful themes that have to be touched on. It's not easy to do. You know, and it's not just me. I mean, that's for all of us.
Sure.
It sounds like we don't have any more questions. Are there any more questions? People are leaving.
In growth. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
You were having trouble hearing whoever's trying to speak.
Go ahead now.
Epithelial cell ingrowth, does anyone have any solution to this? Because they're afraid of lifting that flap and raising it, but yet I can't stay on the medication of Alreg because it will raise the pressure in my eyes, although in a textbook it shouldn't, but my glaucoma is unstable. If I could get my eyes wet, they say the dry eyes makes the epithelial cell ingrowth harder to manage. I'm producing tears, and they've got me on doxycycline right now, desiring the side effects to make the oil glands in the eyes produce more. I'm also on an antibiotic that drops azacite, but this is a temporary thing. It's a temporary usage. I can't stay on these antibiotics.
So you're saying that you have epithelial ingrowth and that the steroid they're giving you potentially increases the pressure in your eye. Right.
The Alreg. So they took me off of that. I'm on the antibiotics by drops and by mouth. And hopefully this doctor in Cincinnati, his name is Ed Holland, Dr. Ed Holland. Hopefully his opinion can put some light on something. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of this doctor, but he's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, it's too bad Ed Boschnick just left the call because he would know something about this and would probably be able to answer your question. Yeah. I would suggest, you know, if you do email Ed, put that into your email to him and ask him what he thinks about it.
Okay. Who did you say that was?
Ed Boschnick.
Ed, and then spell his last name?
B-O-S.
B-O-S.
You'll see him on that iFreedom.com.
Yeah, he's the optometrist who has the iFreedom.com website.
His website. So once you type that in, you'll get all his contact info and everything.
iFreedom.com.
Right.
Okay, I'll see him on there. Okay, I'll put that in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any last words?
So, Roger, I personally wanted, this is Jerry Dorian, and I personally wanted to thank you. I think that this was a great benefit to anyone that joined tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jerry.
Good job, Roger.
Thank you, Paula.
I think the whole presentation was pretty good.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'm glad it. You know, it seemed to go pretty well, and I'm glad it did. And it seemed like it was fairly well received by the audience. And you know, I kind of had my doubts about whether it would be okay or desirable to touch on some of the themes. But it's very difficult to talk about what all of us have been through unless you do touch on those themes. And
well, how do people get better if they just push it back and push it back and push it down and push it down? I mean, don't people have to confront this ever? Be able to get beyond it. It seems like it to me anyway.
Well, I think we're faced with this, you know, that Matt brought up this point earlier about the industry study, and we're faced with a situation in which the industry is going to attempt to define what it's like to be a casualty, or what it should be like to be a casualty. And they're going to try to rewrite reality as we understand it. And they're going to, you know, label us as crazy. We're crazy because we don't have the experience of LASIK that they think we should have, or the experience of LASIK complications that they think that we should have. And I think that our community has to have, we have to have the self-esteem to speak the truth of our lives, and we have to have a certain amount of pride in ourselves to go forward and communicate with society what has happened to us. Otherwise, nobody is ever going to know.
I think the community should continue to stick together and grow and attack the hell out of them because, you know, we're the ones that are going to be swept under the rugs, which we've already been.
What's sad, Dom, is there's so many people that are swept under the rugs that have never joined any of our groups.
Exactly. Exactly.
There are just thousands and thousands and thousands out there that are going through similar experiences, and they're afraid to, just like Scott said, you know, for how many years he just wanted to believe that, you know, that he just didn't want to accept the way things really are, and that's I think the experience of most LASIK patients that have a bad outcome. It's just denial, and it's. And your family doesn't understand you. I mean, even to this day, 9 years later almost for me, my family still does not understand me now.
I'm in the same boat, and I'm going on 12 years.
So if we don't have each other, where do we turn for support and understanding and a sympathetic ear? I feel so bad for all the people out there that don't have a support group. I really do.
And it continues every day. More and more. I mean, this isn't any different than when I first started the website. You know, you still get the number of people hitting the website, you know, albeit now for LASIK lawsuits and, you know, whatever. And it's a shame. I mean, it's pathetic is what it is, because there's, for all the advances in refractive surgery that they claim that have come about, you're still getting the same number of people, if not more, now than you had a couple of years ago.
Well, the number of casualties is still, people are still flowing in to the community, and people are still finding the websites. I don't think it's gone down necessarily.
LASIK has.
Well, LASIK has, but you know, as a percentage of the number of LASIKs done, we're still finding a lot of people that need help. You know, every day people are having complications from LASIK and they need help, and they don't know where to turn. They don't know what the truth is. As Paula said, nobody understands what their situation. I don't know. You know, we hope a little by little that the word gets out, and we hope that the people in our community can take ownership of the things that we've experienced, and that we can all somehow come to grips with the reality of our lives, and we can move forward. And
all right, what about the new administration going in? You got Obama, you got Biden, you got somebody that is going to be taking charge of the FDA or Health and Human Services. What about an onslaught with these people?
Someone want to speak to that?
Well, now you want to talk about what our plans are to address with Congress about these issues?
It's a new Congress, after all. Maybe now's not the time to do it, but, you know.
Is Mel on the call? She's not on the call.
Okay.
But LASIK Surgery Watch does have some plans to, you know, to take this to whatever level we have to take it to try to get, you know, people at FDA to make them do their jobs. I mean, this is something that they need to acknowledge what's happening here, and that's been the problem all along, is LASIK industry does not acknowledge what's happening, and they continue to try to cover it up, and I'm going to call a spade and say, you know, call it what it is, and they continue to try to cover it up. And, you know, I think that's part of why people are so traumatized, because no one acknowledges what's happening to them. Their experiences are being, you know, just thrown away, disregarded, and they need the validation. I mean, if the FDA would finally come out and say that LASIK can cause a bad outcome, from LASIK can lead to psychological issues, then what kind of relief would that be for all these people that are struggling and they're out there on their own and they don't know what to do, they don't know where to turn, they don't have any answers? You know, if the FDA were to acknowledge that this is a syndrome that and people need to be treated for and they need help and they need support, it seems to me like that would help the casualty community. But as long as this is as long as they continue to hide this and to cover it up, it just, how can people ever heal from it? I don't think they can.
Thank you.
Clear evidence that they're, if anything, they being the FDA and this quality of life study is just looking to go the opposite extreme and claim that any kind of mental issues post LASIK are due to pre-existing.
That's exactly what's happening. The medical literature is already being published by Jennifer Morse and Stephen Schellhorn, and they're saying that they're not acknowledging that there's actually something wrong with these patients, that they actually do have severe dry eye, painful chronic dry eye, and their vision is actually severely compromised. That's been completely glossed over, and they're doing these pre-LASIK psychological assessments and trying to tie in patient dissatisfaction after LASIK with pre-existing depressive symptoms. I'm sorry, but that is a cover-up. That's what it is.
And without even considering, or with never discussing in this literature, any kind of physical complications post-LASIK.
Not at all. They don't even acknowledge that there are complications. They don't even acknowledge that patients can have bad outcomes. What they try to present to the public is that some people are not satisfied with their outcome, and they give the impression that it may just be a slight refractive error or something, but it's just they're not totally satisfied. Maybe they didn't hit 20/10 and they're not satisfied, and they're completely ignoring the complications.
I didn't even settle for 20 legal, but obviously that's not the case.
If
the FDA goes forward with this prospective quality of life study with the LASIK industry, with ASCRS and the AAO, then I mean we're never going to get out of the position we're in. We're always going to be stuck where we are. we're never going to be able to move past this and we're never going to be able to help patients, because how are we going to help patients when we can't even help ourselves? We're all stuck in this. We're all stuck here.
Yeah.
Well, all we can do is keep fighting or give up.
No, I ain't giving up, that's for damn sure.
We just want them to acknowledge what's happened.
Right.
And to prevent it from happening to more people.
Right.
That would be nice.
I think the one thing we do know is that there are going to be changes at the FDA. It's not simply a matter of LASIK. There's lots of other things in the FDA.
I've already been made aware of that. I think our
biggest problem is going to be getting this on the agenda at the FDA, getting anyone to pay attention to this. And really the only chance we have is to try to grow this, to try to get more people.
Yeah.
That's, if anyone that's on this call knows anyone who's sympathetic, anyone who has had LASIK in the past, family members, we have to grow an organization or we're never going to get anywhere. If we're going to have to try to depend on isolated people doing things separately, we'll never get a voice.
That's a good point, Jerry.
Okay, where do I sign up?
Well, I assume you've signed up to LASIK Surgery Watch, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, and if you have any contacts of other LASIK patients, be sure that let them know as well to sign up. That's one step. Yeah. And then more news to come.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like we're wrapping up here. Mr. Roger, you want to close out anyway, or?
No, I think we had a pretty good discussion. I guess we're done, huh?
Great. Well, thanks again, Roger, and thanks everyone for joining.
Good night, everyone.
All right. And Darren, good night, everyone. Everybody, take care. Roger, great job.
Yeah, thanks, Roger.
Thank you.